In other news.
You know, the towers did not burn up. They turned into powder in midair.
That's scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to him and confront him. They can't stand that.
Welcome to another news. I'm Jeff Brady. We've discussed in detail on this show the various sources of microwave radiation in our environment, including mobile phones, cell towers, and so-called smart meters. In past interviews, guests such as Amy Worthington explain the types of harmful effects from exposure to microwave radiation and RF, such as 24 hours of cell phone use equals 1,600 chest x-rays. Or wireless radiation opens the blood-brain barrier, allowing access for aluminum and sodium fluoride. The Russian government has warned pregnant mothers not to use cell phones. Past guest Dr. Konstantin Kordkov mentioned that in Russia it's forbidden to have schools, farms, and buildings under high-intensity electrical wires. Not unlike the ubiquitous digital television conversion forced upon the public here in the West, nearly every cubic inch of space in our urban environments is now saturated with wireless frequency. Yet, in the Western world, caution against exposure to these frequencies was not properly released to the public. For some reason, manufacturers of these products and various agencies responsible for warning consumers didn't think it was necessary to effectively warn the public about the potential harm emanating from their devices. Remember the interview with Josh Del Sol, director of Take Back Your Power. In his documentary, it was pointed out by researchers how some people will feel wireless radiation expressed through headaches or feeling very weak, and some will not. Yet within both types of people reacting differently, the blood shows an adverse effect, meaning that those people that don't feel any symptoms are still being affected by the microwave radiation. We talked today with Heather Lean about electromagnetic hypersensitivity, or EHS. Heather is a musician and activist who has recently found a place free of electromagnetic fields where she says that she can now begin to heal her body. The condition is defined on conventional websites as a group of symptoms purportedly caused by exposure to electromagnetic fields. The World Health Organization concluded in a study from 2005 that the symptoms are certainly real and can vary widely in their severity, yet claims there's no scientific basis to link EHS symptoms to EMF exposure. Did you notice the word purportedly caused by exposure to electromagnetic fields, or no scientific basis linking EHS symptoms to EMF exposure? It's not very surprising. The reported symptoms of EHS include headache, fatigue, stress, sleep disturbances, skin symptoms such as prickling, burning sensations, and rashes. There's also pain and aches in the muscles and many other health problems. Heather Lean joins us right now. Heather, welcome to Another News.
Hi.
Well, we just heard a general definition of EHS in the introduction, but as someone who is experiencing EHS, can you give us a take on the condition?
Well, first I'd like to clarify that the term electrohypersensitivity is fitting in some ways for what we suffer from and for what I suffer, but I also find it a little accusatory, and I like to make sure people understand that it's a reaction to radiation that is natural, because we're faced with frequencies that are completely foreign to us as biological beings. So I just wanted to sort of point that out, that even though the terminology is kind of in place and it's called EHS or ES for electrosensitivity, I feel really strongly that that sort of puts the onus on us as sufferers. And people sometimes say to us, well, you're just sensitive, I'll be fine. But I just want people to understand that all the testing proves that we're all having the same biological effects. Some of us have kind of upregulated immune systems that want us to get away from it. So my own suffering with it began after a long neglected diagnosis for a Lyme infection, Lyme and co-infection. It kind of looked like a fibromyalgia type of reaction, an inflammation, a systemic inflammation reaction. It also looked like like migraines and kind of brain fog and things like that, and just general malaise and fatigue. That was my initial reaction to it. For many years, those were my symptoms. And I was getting a little bit more inundated with wireless microwave signals during that time when everybody started to have Wi-Fi, and I began to use a cell phone periodically. I lived in a low-signal area in Vermont, so I didn't use a cell phone a lot, but, you know, I'd had one. And then cordless phones also, I started, I think, to use them a little bit more frequently during that time, so it started to build for me. But then ultimately, when they put so-called smart meters into town in Brattleboro, Vermont, where I was living briefly, that's when I started to have really acute reactions.
Could you describe what those reactions were?
They were very pronounced. I literally was convulsing almost 24 hours a day. My whole body was so overloaded by electricity, regular electromagnetic fields that we're used to in our households. But then the microwave sort of pushed me over the edge. And particularly my legs were kind of moving, and I couldn't hold them still when I was trying to sleep. I know that there's a medical term called restless leg syndrome, and I think it's interesting that it coincided with people's wireless use. And I know that the medical industry gives people pills for that, but they don't know what causes it. But the analogy I make now that I look back is that when those smart meters were put into town and we were really inundated with 24-hour signals that were pulsing microwaves that we couldn't, you know, control or turn off, the analogy that I make is it's kind of like when you see footage of people that are electrocuted in the electric chair and their bodies kind of dance from the electricity, and it was like that. I mean, a lot milder version, but that's how my body seemed to be reacting now that I look back on it. And it was painful. Like, I felt burning sensations and I felt numbness. And ultimately, when I used my MacBook with Wi-Fi, I started to feel it when I opened the computer and the Wi-Fi was enabled, that there were little daggers just jabbing me in the eyes, which was really traumatic. And ultimately, it prevented me from using my computer at all. And I did have an experience when I was close to a cell tower using a BlackBerry phone on speakerphone. I had an experience where I could feel the energy as I approached the tower in the car just shooting through me, and I had what seemed like a seizure, like maybe a petit mal seizure, where I just kind of, everything just shut down, everything went blank, and I couldn't really think or walk or talk for hours after that. And that was the last time that I used a cell phone that way, and that was in 2012.
It's interesting you say that when you drove by the cell phone towers, those giant masts on the sides of highways, and on a trip to Philadelphia once on the New Jersey Turnpike, I had filmed as many of these masts as I could. And sometimes I didn't know if it was my imagination, but I could feel the energy from them as we drove by. But now that you're saying this, and you're extremely sensitive to this type of energy and radiation, maybe there is something to this.
Yeah, I mean, I was completely uninformed. I was completely ignorant about what the radio frequency spectrum for these devices was. I didn't understand it was microwave frequency the same as a microwave oven. I didn't know any of that. And like I said, I used a cell phone really intermittently in Vermont because we just don't have tower coverage. The population is so low there. And so, you know, when I was inundated with towers everywhere and antenna everywhere in the city for a duration of time, I think, you know, after having become so ill as well, it was just too much for me. But I will also say that before I left Vermont for Portland for naturopathic medical treatment for Lyme, I did start to experience sensitivity to the furnace. The fan from the furnace would go on, things with dirty electricity. I was aware that CFL bulbs were causing me to feel ill and have some vision problems, some light sensitivity problems. And then the dryer, my little clothes dryer, I have a small portable dryer, which is probably a lower electromagnetic field than a lot of appliances, that it made me want to jump out of my skin, and all my symptoms were pronounced if I turned the dryer on. I literally had to turn the dryer on and run and leave the house, which you're never advised to leave the dryer on when you're not home, but that was the only way I could dry my clothes towards the tail end of living in Vermont. So then when I got to Portland, everything just became more exacerbated, and I found myself driving around in the city, inundated, like you said, like when you were talking about documenting towers in Philadelphia, I was realizing that I was inundated by these towers, and they were literally everywhere. In Portland, it's very dense, the masts and the antennas. They put them up on water towers, on buildings. They're all up along and up and down the highway. Like, it seemed like every quarter mile or so, there was like masts everywhere. And so I could feel everything. It was like I was being tortured. It was like somebody was chasing me with a cattle prod. If I was in a building that had Wi-Fi, or if I was out driving, it was like I felt like I was being electrocuted. I could feel it kind of running through my hair. And, you know, I was trying to use different fabrics and trying to find different ways to shield, and I was not very well informed about how to protect myself. And literally, there's no way to completely protect yourself when you're out in it. You're in it, and you have to, you know, go to the countryside to be safe from it. But one of the things that was really interesting to me is that I noticed there are a lot of Priuses out west. I don't know if they really caught on in California and Oregon more than back east, but they seem to be everywhere. Maybe because I could feel them, I was noticing them more. But if I was behind one on the road, I had to keep my distance from it. And there were people that would try to pass me and get in between me and the Prius because I was keeping such a so many car lengths between me and that that type of vehicle. And the Priuses would make me feel like if I got too close to them, if I got too close to their tailgate, I could feel as though it felt like it was pulling my face off. Like the electricity from the batteries felt like it was pulling at my face and my forehead. And then I would feel really drained after that. So I tried to avoid them. If they got behind me, I would pull over and let them pass. And it became part of my ritual of trying to get around the city.
The Prius story is very interesting to me. That's very new, that level of sensitivity in people. I want to go back just for a second on two things. One is the clusters of cell masts on water towers. And listeners, if you remember the Japanese and Russian scientists who did those experiments where they would scream at a glass of water, freeze it, and then slice it and look at the ice under a microscope, and the structures would be very disjointed. The opposite of that would be to say these loving words or play classical music to the water, freeze it, slice it, look at it under the microscope, and you would see very symmetrical geometry. And I thought that's interesting in the context of these cell towers up and around water towers for entire communities.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
It really struck me. I was going down the New Jersey Turnpike and seeing these, and I thought, well, that can't be good. That can't be good for the drinking water. So there's that aspect of it. But also, could you tell listeners that you lived in Vermont for a while, and then you traveled to Portland, Oregon. You traveled out west to see if it was a little bit better for you.
I traveled out west seeking naturopathic medical care for what had become chronic Lyme. In the Northeast, my symptoms were ignored by all of the major teaching hospitals throughout New England.
Now, Heather, I got to stop you there. For listeners, we're talking about EHS, but there's also another component here. You had Lyme because of a tick bite?
The theory is that it's transmitted mostly by infected ticks. Lyme and co-infections will can be transmissible through ticks, but there's also information that it can be transmissible from other insects and other arachnids. And then there's some theories about passing it on through sexual transmission as well. And so there's nobody's completely positive how so many people wind up with it. But then there's the congenital factor too. Your mother can pass it to you through breast milk or in utero, and there's more than one way to get it. So I think, as a precautionary tale, most people will console themselves that they haven't had any visible tick bite or, telltale, quote-unquote, bullseye rash. But many of the nymph ticks as well will not leave any mark, and they can just be on you momentarily and infect you in a second and then drop off. So if you're in a tick-ridden area, like most of New England and many parts of New York State, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, up and down, the Mid-Atlantic region, and then out here where I'm now residing in California and parts of Oregon as well are becoming more endemic with us too. But yeah, the other cautionary tale as far as the medical industry goes is that their CDC ELISA test, as it's called, for Lyme, is 80% inaccurate, 80% fail rate. There's a fantastic documentary that was produced and shown at Sundance in 2009 called Under Our Skin, and it reveals all of the details about why this CDC test is inaccurate and talks about an Igenix Western blot test to replace that you have to pay for out of pocket. It won't be insured, but that test is accurate, and that's the one I finally had from my positive results. And so I kept looking for help medically, realized the medical industry was failing me. I had an endocrinologist at Dartmouth in New Hampshire tell me that Lyme was a cult and that he didn't want to hear about Lyme when I had finally gotten my positive diagnosis. So that frightened me all the more, and I started looking into naturopathy, but the naturopaths in Vermont were very ham-fisted and were making me sicker as well. What happened to me, and part of the reason why my sensitivities to microwaves and electromagnetic fields were so heightened, is that I had just gotten incredibly ill over the course of more than a decade of neglecting, to get the diagnosis. And so, I got pushed to my limit. I've got other factors too. Trauma is a big factor for many of us with electrohypersensitivity. Having pathogens like Lyme, these things seem to create a perfect storm in many of us. Mm-hmm. It's like an environmental illness perfect storm. And then the hypervigilance that people experience when they have been abused or traumatized, it just sort of adds to the hypervigilance of the immune system and the nervous system when it comes to being able to detect things that are dangerous in our environment. That's why a lot of other people with these conditions with Lyme also present with MCS, which is multiple chemical sensitivity, and they also present with a lot of mold reactivity as well. So I had a little bit of those combined, but my electrosensitivity just became off the charts for various reasons, because it was tied into some of my trauma, and that's how the body works. The body will remember, all of these things and keep track of them and become hypervigilant about them.
I find it unusual that there's a connection with Lyme and EHS, but you just made that connection there. And can you describe that a little deeper for listeners? What exactly is going on there? Because you have Lyme, does it make you more sensitive to the radiation?
It does. These pathogens, Lyme and co-infections, it's usually Lyme, Babesia, Bartonella. Sometimes there's Rocky Mountain spotted fever can be thrown in there too. I think that's called Ericula. I'm not sure how to pronounce that one. But then there's also opportunistic infections that occur in the body that include many different viruses, usually a high level of candida, and other kinds of fungal infections can increase when you're depleted like that. And the thing about the Lyme spirochetes is that they alter the immune system, they trick the immune system, and they sort of become one with your DNA. Candida can do this as well. Another thing they do is they hide in things called biofilms and cysts. So they can be in a dormant phase when they feel like they're being attacked. Many, many patients who have used antibiotics to try to cure these infections will wind up throwing them into a cyst form where they become dormant for even up to a decade or more, and then having an even more virulent infection to battle later. And many people that go through that more than once choose a naturopathic approach and avoid antibiotics in medical industry after they've been through that phase of the cyst form and then getting sick again. But the thing that the Lyme does, too, is that it entwines with your immune system and your nervous system, and it becomes a part of you. I mean, we're all made up of microbes and bacteria and many things that are not of us that we collect along the way and that we're born with. And sometimes what happens for people who become sensitive, another aspect is that the Lyme and the Candida especially despise electricity and really don't like radiation exposure. And they will react and cause your body to react, and basically they're telling you as the host to get away from the source of the irritation to them. Another thing that's a factor for people who react intensely and part of the perfect storm and part of my my prognosis here is that heavy metal in the body, like high levels of mercury, etc., can really make you more like an antenna, so that you're conducting these frequencies, you know, just like the masts are, just like the cell phone antenna is, you're also conducting them. So they're kind of rattling through you, and, you know, and you're feeling them because, you know, they're not supposed to be there. I don't know if that answers your question a little bit better.
It actually does. I was curious about that, and you call it the perfect storm. It's when a lot of these conditions come together, and then all of a sudden you're feeling the batteries from a Prius in front
yeah,
of you.
Yeah, and the dryer. Ultimately, the dryer, when I was in Portland where I was staying, the person who owned the building I was staying in, we had to never use the dryer, or when we did, I had to flee to the park with my cats or something in order to avoid it. But at one point, the dryer was on the next door neighbor, was a condominium, so they were quite close. And I started to be unable to keep my balance. I was feeling pulled to the right, like pulled to the ground. I couldn't even stand up. So it's like science fiction. It really doesn't seem like it can be real. But when it happens to you, and it's happening to millions of people, the conservative numbers in the United States are that 12 million people suffer from electrosensitivity. And we know that that's way higher, because the people that are just getting the aches and pains and migraines are included in that as sufferers, but they just have no idea what they're suffering from, and the medical industry will just give you pain pills, you know? They never get to the bottom of this. So it's an amazing thing to go through, and my feelings about it, and everyone that I've talked to in the electrosensitivity groups and the Lyme patients that have endured this, we just can't believe it's happening to us. And we keep thinking it's just going to stop. Like, it can't be real. We must be imagining it. But it's very real. And when you read about how the symptoms are generated by this exposure, it just becomes clear. And I wound up doing a lot of research because I wanted to know what was happening to me and how to stop it. And when I arrived in Portland, I met somebody who had been reporting on these issues for a while. And he had a lot of information, you know, kind of piled up from different sources. And I started to look through it. I started to look online a little more. I used a hardwired connection and didn't expose myself to Wi-Fi. And I was able to be in front of the computer at a distance for short periods of time. And I learned that the Army, the military, actually the naval papers were available through Magda Havas's site. She's an MD in Canada who's been very anti-radiation for quite some time. She had the naval documents on her site, and they delineated the whole battery of symptoms and reactions that people and animals had when they were exposed to these signals. Because this is a microwave weapon technology, and it winds up kind of, you know, causing the same symptoms in everyone. when they're exposed to it. So that was interesting to me. And I was also confused about why they would implement it into like a civilian communication or entertainment technology.
Right.
And I still have a lot of questions about that. And I am more open-minded about, you know, having doubts that it was not deliberate ultimately, because it just doesn't seem to make sense that they would be exposing us to this. And now that I know more, I also know that it's causing DNA breaks, blood-brain barrier breach, the destruction of the pineal gland, which is where melatonin is produced so that we can't sleep, and a whole host of other issues with the body, including like heart arrhythmia. The list is really quite long. If you ever look it up online, you can see all the symptoms and all the reactions. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you in your intro, I think you're speaking about how there's no scientific evidence, but the scientific evidence is available. It's just not, it's very much suppressed. I don't know if I can, at this point, point the listeners in the direction of a place they can find more information.
I kind of did that on purpose because the World Health Organization mentions that, and
That's
what the debunkers would say. And that was a question I wanted to ask you. There are these social experiences related to the EHS condition, ranging from indifference to disdain for being too sensitive.
Yeah.
What do you think is going on with the reaction psychologically?
I think it's multifold. A lot of people think that the FCC and the governments around the world would not subject us to this, and they're very trusting that we are using things that are safe for us. They also see that microwave frequencies have been used in devices similar to this for a long time. But the major difference is that now everybody has a microwave transmitter in their pocket, and there's 30 million times more microwave radiation in our environment between the towers, the Wi-Fi, the cell phones, and all the other weird gadgets that keep getting pushed on us through the market that are wireless, including odd things like baby toys and forks and things that are just bizarre, you know? Everything's wireless, clothing things. I don't even know half the applications at this point. I just know that they're numerous and becoming more and more. I think that basically people feel like they can trust, you know, whoever is overseeing this. And I also think that they get addicted to these devices very quickly. People are constantly checking their phones. I saw people in Portland that would walk across the street looking at their phones. Their thumbs are always engaged texting people. It's always, you know, bells going off and them answering and looking, and, you know, and it seems like that's part of it. They don't want to give that up. Even though it's taken over their lives and probably destroyed their social interactions tremendously. So I think that's a big part of it too. But I also think that people would always like to perceive you as the other. You know, like it used to be that if you want to look at this as a disability, which I don't, because I think it is a natural reaction and not kind of like, again, putting the onus on the sufferer. But if you want to look at it as a disability, at one point, people that were disabled were just marginalized and disenfranchised. So that's kind of where we're at, if you wanted to take that tack on it. And we are kind of like trying to say, you know, this is making us sick, and it means it's making you sick too, but people want to say, no, it's just you. It's just your problem. It's really a shame that you can't use these devices. You know, I'm not going to turn my Wi-Fi off for you. You can't come into my store. I've been kicked out of medical facilities and stores because I have an RF meter that measures the signal, and I use it as a medical device essentially to protect myself and measure the signal before I get very ill from it. And I've been kicked out of stores for using that device. People want to be in denial, and legislation has to be in place to protect people, which is a really sad truth. But the other thing that's more sad than that is that the blood-brain barrier breach that they're experiencing is predisposing them to Alzheimer's, amongst other, you know, ailments. And their exposure to these signals, especially to the head and carrying the phones on their bodies, is a precursor to cancer. I mean, they're going to wind up with some form of cancer if they keep doing it. The odds are greater and greater, and the devices are emitting more and more radiation constantly. I've seen iPhones that basically shoot out 50,000 microwatts per square meter sitting in somebody's pocket. So, I guess that's my explanation. People want to be in denial, And that brings me to the website that has a lot of the information on it that you can peruse. It's called ignoranceanddenial.org.
Mm-hmm.
And I named it that because I felt as though that's the two camps we're dealing with. And in some cases, we're dealing with people that are having that in conjunction with each other, the ignorance and the denial. So, but yeah, we do experience a lot of discrimination, and people even become like angry and violent and take it personally should you ask them to turn their device off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you need to toughen up.
Exactly. Oh boy, I have though, believe me.
Our guest is Heather Lean, and we're talking about electromagnetic hypersensitivity and related conditions. We'll be right back after this break. There was an article just today I saw about parents being concerned about their teenage children on iPhones. It might have been a report, but it was basically an article saying, if you want your children to learn traditionally or effectively, you need to take their cell phones away from them because they're addicted to it in an unhealthy way. If you think about all the different stages of growth socially in a teenager's life, and if you didn't have a cell phone, you would probably do things a little differently, and you might be more motivated to travel and meet people face to face as opposed to merely picking up the device and checking it to see if, you know, there's communication available about any particular topic.
Mm-hmm.
They're pointing out that it's stunting growth and things like that. You alluded to that a little bit, but I'm curious, since you've done a lot of research in this area, what are your thoughts on that in particular?
Well, what has been discovered, even people as mainstream and kind of conservative as Deborah Davis, who's done research and come out publicly about the dangers, especially with children, for cell phone use, is that cell phones, when they're in proximity to children, even, let alone up to their heads, which is far more dangerous, of course, the closer you get to it, the more absorption rate you're going to have. Cell phone radiation completely encompasses the entire brain of a child. Up until late teenage, early 20 years, the development of the tissues allows more radiation, and plus the size of the head, the dimensions of your head are smaller, so it just goes straight through. In adults, they often show the thermal imaging where the cell phone radiation will just be on the side of the head where the phone is being used. But children are heavily exposed, and because we don't really know, well, we do know it's bad, but we don't know how bad it is for children to have these exposures. We don't know how much developmental damage is happening. Then there's the whole social issue that you mentioned, and there's also the learning difficulties. I mean, when you are bypassing, traditional learning and just having these devices and typing and not writing things out, there are parts of the brain that aren't being used, and they can become atrophied. And they're starting to show, now that we've had cell phone use and tablet use in schools for a long enough period, they're starting to show that there are definitely discrepancies in the brains of children that are using these things than in the brains of children that weren't or aren't.
Really? Oh, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, that's. I'm not sure if that's on the site. There might not. There's a site called Wired Child. There might be more information about those specific things. This is pretty new information. But I also want to add that new, as far as legislation goes, is in France, a Green Party member there, Laurence Albier, I think her name is, she actually fought really hard for the rights of parents to keep their children exposed less to Wi-Fi signals, and so she got legislation passed with her group of lawmakers that's banning Wi-Fi signal in public places. So basically, there's not going to be any exposure for children where any child under 3 can go, and that's pretty much everywhere. That was a couple of months ago. I don't know if it's been instituted entirely yet, but that's good progress for us worldwide. There are also white zones. They're called white zones, where people can be free of signal in various countries of in Europe, in the European Union, including Sweden and Italy, Germany and France. So, and I think there was in Spain, but I'm not sure if that's, I'm not sure how much this is government condoned either or just private. But I think that in Sweden especially, there are some government condoned or government, you know, recognized places that people can be free of signal because they do see it as an impairment there. It's like a step, I guess, below a disability, but they do see it as an impairment, and they recognize that, you know, it's truly happening to people.
In the introduction, I mentioned the documentary by Josh Del Sol, Take Back Your Power, and they did that experiment where they showed, they had people stand next to a smart meter for a couple minutes, and they drew blood, and they looked at the blood, and it had an effect. But people, you know, it was either bottle capping or clumping or whatever it was doing.
Yeah, it clumps because the polarity is affected, and I guess it changes the polarity of the cells, and they don't interact. They don't function the way they're supposed to any longer, is my understanding of it. I mean, this is a layperson's understanding of it. But yeah.
Now, that alone should be important evidence in any court case to show your physiology is being affected. Now, what was interesting about that is the people that were tested, all of them had an effect in terms of their blood. However, not all of them felt like, I feel fine, nothing's wrong. But
a lot of people don't feel it in real time. Some of us do. Those of us who do the canaries, as it were, in the coal mine, my feeling is that instead of being ignored or dismissed or, you know, even marginalized, whatever the terminology is, we should just sort of be your canaries. We should alert you. We should alert the rest of everybody. But yeah, that's truly what's going on. Dr. Klinghart, he also has done a lot of experiments on the way that proteins are folded, and he'll take an electrosensitive, say, wife. It's a lot of times it's a woman that's going to be more sensitive than the man for whatever reasons, and he'll take the husband who is non-reactive, and they live in the same environment, and he'll test them both for various things, including protein, the existence of these proteins or how they're folded. I forget what the experiment is exactly. Pardon me for not knowing more scientific details. But his point is also that he finds that they're identical. Their reactions, their physical reactions are identical, even though she's like pulling out her hair and screaming and running from the smart meter and trying to shield herself so she can sleep at night. And he seems to be fine. But they're both having these same significant biological changes. Another thing that people love to say, this really grates at my nerves, they say, it's everywhere. You can't do anything about it. Mm. And that is like just so upsetting because, yes, it is everywhere. We are being inundated. It's ubiquitous. But, yes, we can do something about it, and we must do something about it, not only in our own personal spaces, but, you know, even the most crippled amongst us from these signals have become activists because this can't go on. And one of the things that I try to relate to people that I find incredibly upsetting about the signals and the experiments that have been done is in Sweden, Dr. Leif Salford, who is a neurosurgeon who started to see so many cases of glioma, which is a terrible inoperable brain tumor in Sweden, since cell phone use started in the early to mid-1980s there, they had a lot more cases of these brain tumors coming through. We're starting to see them now, but they saw them, you know, maybe a decade or two earlier, a decade and a half earlier. So he started doing experiments with some help on rats. They did rat studies exposing them to Wi-Fi signals specifically. And they saw the evidence of the blood-brain barrier breach after dissecting the rats' brains. And they have photographs of it. It's basically like a million little dark spots throughout the brain that shouldn't be there. Mm. And the other thing that they found, incidentally, as they continued on with these experiments, because they repeated them over and over, is that they did up to five generations of rats, and they found that after five generations or so, there was sterility across the board in the subjects of these experiments in the rats. And so what they're saying is that within five generations, sterility is another major side effect of this exposure. And we know that men are becoming sterile when they have the cell phones in their pockets.
Mm-hmm.
That's really becoming more and more common. Fertility issues are on the rise, especially for men with cell phones in their pockets. So Leif Salford says, you know, it'll take 150 years for us to hit five generations. And already there's no turning back because the experiment is already underway. We're all a part of this experiment, and our genome and our DNA is being destroyed by it permanently.
Quite insidious how it's been incorporated into our inherent need to communicate.
Yeah. And also, you know, it's very diabolical that landlines are being removed. And this is infrastructure that's already there that they shouldn't touch. And, you know, they're pulling copper wire out and defeating it and not wanting to maintain that in lieu of doing everything wirelessly. It's really deeply disturbing how things are moving and how people are either ignorant or in denial about it. And, you know, one of the goals that we have in our individual activism and our group activism, you know, against these devices is that we really, really want to get the word out there. It seems like there's more and more mainstream reporting, but it's always very watered down, and they never seem to focus on the kinds of studies that are going on in Europe. And the documentaries that seem to reveal the most are coming from Europe, from the UK, from Germany, from Sweden, and from Spain as well. There's a great one from Spain that whose name I cannot remember at the moment. I feel like the awareness is coming very slowly, and it's just disturbing because not only can we not live our lives, those of us who are feeling so terrible from all of these signals, but it is kind of catastrophic what's happening. And I mean, it's not kind of catastrophic, it's catastrophic what's happening. The repercussions are just huge, and they're multifold. And they're being ignored. They're being suppressed. Telecom suppresses, you know, governments are in collusion with telecom. And I mean, imagine if telecom crashed tomorrow, financially, what would be going on? I mean, nobody wants to see that happen because they just, you know, they make zillions of dollars every day from everyone having these devices.
Heather, there's another component here that we mentioned that you mentioned in a prior conversation to this interview, and you noticed a particular increase in personality disorders. How does this relate to EHS or our current mobile phone society?
That's kind of a little bit of a dichotomy there, isn't it? Because the average person's concept of, say, narcissism is kind of related to people who only think of themselves and are very selfish, and, you know, the whole phenomenon of taking selfies of themselves and posting constantly and things like that kind of ties into that. But what I've found is that the pathological kind of personality disorders seem to be another factor emotionally and psychologically for people that suffer from this hypervigilance that predisposes you kind of to chemical sensitivity, mold sensitivity, and electrical sensitivity. I'm loath to mention this and have people say, oh, that means it's all in their minds, right? That's not what I want to do because that's not what I've observed. But what I am trying to say is it seems like the pathogens, the infections, the diminished or hyper-regulated immune system, and also the trauma component sort of combine here and cause people to kind of get into a limbic injury situation. They get into like a trauma loop situation where the sensitivity is real, but it's heightened and it's kind of brought on in some ways by psychological aspects. And what I have learned in interviewing people who have radiation reactions, electrohypersensitivity, etc., is that they have a trauma component, and across the board, they're dealing with either a spouse or family members, or they themselves present with, it seems most commonly, cluster B personality disorder. and that's the dramatic cluster that encompasses borderline and narcissism, and there's a lot of other smatterings of disorder from different clusters that people have. Nobody's ever like a clean break of, you know, one thing and not another. But these personality disorder presentations, it's kind of like a spectrum, I guess. You could look at it like a spectrum, like the autistic spectrum. They kind of predispose people to having hypervigilance. And when you're subjected to somebody's personality disorder in your family or your partner, then you become traumatized by that. It's a constant, usually low-level trauma with maybe some heightened incidence depending on, you know, the other person's pathology. And like I said, often the people that get involved with partners that are ill with this have been raised with it themselves, and so they seek this familiar. And in my own case, my familial background is that pretty much all of the men in my family were disordered. My father was definitely a narcissist. My mother definitely had borderline traits. And I was subjected to a lot of that trauma in my childhood. And when I, you know, sought partners as a heterosexual adult, I chose men that were disordered, that fit that cluster B kind of presentation, including my ex-husband, who was misdiagnosed as bipolar, but he was very much a borderline with narcissistic traits and, you know, addiction too, unfortunately. So there was a lot of trauma and a lot of abuse. And during the time that I was leaving my husband for the final time, I, you know, started to become aware that my symptoms seemed to be getting better as I got away from him. And then, you know, worsened whenever I encountered him or even thought about him in some cases. And, you know, I had since figured out what it was, but I also had trouble making that break and not being attracted to people like that. I had a couple more that I got involved with, but I was, like, more aware of what they were presenting with, and I was able to kind of keep myself from getting sucked in. They call it hoovering. They literally call it hoovering because they sort of suck you in. And the cycles and phases that people with personality disorder victimize people with are a phase of being abusive and then a phase of being remorseful for the abuse or seeming to be remorseful. But the lack of empathy that a lot of the people with personality disorder have leaves you kind of cold and leaves you kind of always waiting for the other shoe to drop and always in this state of hypervigilance. So what I've found is that this occurs with most of the, especially women, that are suffering from electrosensitivity. They really, you know, they're in the midst of getting divorced from a narcissistic husband, or, you know, their father was one, or they've had that in their past and now they've figured out what it is and moved away from it, but they still carry the trauma. And one of the things, again, I'll mention Dr. Klinghardt, who, full disclosure, I intermittently work for his nutritional brand, but I definitely agree with a lot of the points he makes, and many other naturopaths and alternative medical doctors say the same thing, that trauma is a huge, huge part of this. Processing out the trauma and dealing with the limbic injury through limbic retraining, that's one method, can be really helpful for us. I know my own experience is that even though it's not in my head, it's in my nervous system, more appropriate to say, there is a limbic injury. And I do prepare myself for the onslaught of signal when I start to feel symptomatic. We can't stop the biological effects of all of the things that we're being assaulted with, but we can try to calm our nervous system down so that we can function in the world. And that's one of the things that I've learned that's been very helpful for me. And I'm far more functional now, but I won't live in signal. I won't sleep in signal. I won't even sleep with electricity on because I want my body to repair itself. I want my melatonin to be produced. I want my pineal gland intact. But, you know, this is just another part of trying to heal and trying to understand that we're on a trauma loop where, you know, we're suffering from all sides, basically. And again, it speaks to the perfect storm concept.
You're in a tent right now in Northern California.
I'm in a tent palace. Excuse me.
If you would describe it, I don't even know what it looks like. You're on a you're on a landline somehow. I don't even.
I'm on a landline. I have a 500-foot cable to a building on the property where I live. I live in Northern California, and I fled Portland because I was literally dying there from signal. I had no functionality at all, and I was in agony all the time, inflamed, you know, unable to think, etc. In some cases, unable to walk when the dryer was on. So I fled. I came here to decompress. I found, through amazing serendipity, an older couple had a nice little spot that I could throw my tent. So I threw a 12-by-12 hunter's tent with a wood stove. We were having rain then. That was when it was still raining. And I plunked myself down in late winter here, and I've been here for about a year and a half now. Since then, I've expanded. I've had an outdoor kitchen since I arrived. But I also threw another couple little small Coleman tents in front of the 12-by-12. So I have this like room for my little portable washer and dryer. And I have a stock tank as a bathtub with a propane hot water heater. And it's palatial now.
I'd like to see what that looks like. You know,
you're,
if you can.
You're invited. You're invited.
Excellent.
Whenever you like. Whenever you want to decompress. Yeah. So, but basically, putting myself into this situation was the first stage in trying to get all of the excess electricity out of my body and get the exposure down to nil, you know, or near nil. And I had a very little electricity when I arrived. I do have access to an ag pole so I can plug in, but I didn't have a refrigerator and I wasn't using appliances of any sort. When I arrived, everything still inflamed me. I could step over an extension cord and feel electricity shoot through my body, actually, initially, when I first got here. So I did a lot of grounding. I'm in my stocking feet right now outside sitting on my car. And I did a lot of naturopathic therapies, too, to remyelinate, because demyelination, and it's another part of the perfect storm, your nerve sheathing starts to get eaten away when you have Lyme. The autoimmune response to the body is really intense, and the body's looking for the Lyme. The immune system searching for the infection can't find it and starts to attack you. Pretty much all autoimmune diseases can be attributed to the root of it is usually an infection. And Lyme presents as many, many types of autoimmune diseases, just to name a few, ALS, MS. There are many, many demyelination disorders that are connected to this. So anyway, I started to rebuild my myelin, the myelin sheath, and I was able to get less sensitive with that, and I was able to become less sensitive just from being away from signal as well, just to have the body not be constantly assaulted, calm down the reactions immensely. So then, you know, now I have little appliances. I can listen to my little, you know, compact stereo again. I'm able to pretty much be exposed to all electrical devices comfortably. I can sit at the computer. Again, everything is hardwired, no wireless. That's still something that I don't do well with. But I can go into town and do my errands, and I can drive, you know, into the city and go see a show. I even took a flight to see my favorite band a couple of months ago up in Portland, and I had a 24-hour stint in Portland. By the time I got back, I was pretty shaken, and it took me a bit of time to recover, but I was not feeling the towers that I was seeing everywhere any longer, and I was able to, you know, to enjoy myself while I was there. So things are improving, and you can improve your symptoms, definitely, if you take a multi-pronged approach, but I still, you know, struggling financially and also really trying to put all of my money into naturopathic care to keep treating and rebuilding my body and my immune system, and then ultimately, hopefully, killing off infection as well. I'm just in the beginning phases of that.
Well, Heather, if some listeners are going through something similar here, what words of advice or website would you want them to look at for additional help?
There are many Facebook groups for electrosensitivity. You can just sort of type in electrosensitivity, and we have people showing up internationally to these groups daily, and it's really phenomenal. We really can get right in there with them and help them understand the kind of testing that they might need to do to find underlying pathogens and help them understand like the basic ways to shield where they are, because sometimes shielding in place is the only thing you can do, at least initially, until you can find a safer place to be. A lot of people do have to flee their homes. Many, many do flee their homes because of towers or smart meters or neighbors' Wi-Fi, et cetera. So that's right now our best support, is to just find us on those groups. Like I said, they are international. We're definitely out there supporting everybody with this that has, you know, that's flung into this, because most of the time you have low-lying symptoms, pain, inflammation, and then suddenly, like I said, for me, it happened, and it happens this way for many sufferers. We just suddenly can't do anything or go anywhere. Some people feel electrocuted by their cells when they start to feel, you know, shocked from it, essentially, or they feel a headache when they put it near their head. So all those people, you know, just a word out there to New York City. Everybody in the city that's feeling these things, is not in your imagination. It's real. You know, there are things that we can do to help you get through the initial phases of figuring out that this has gone on with you.
Heather Lean, I really appreciate you explaining this in detail and your personal experiences with it. It's very valuable. And you're a musician and activist in this particular area. The website is called ignoranceanddenial.org. Thank you so much for being on In Other News.
It's been a real pleasure. I'm so glad that I connected with you, Jeff, and I'm really glad that you can bring this out, you know, and have people get the information. We need to do this more and more. We have to talk about this.
I agree. And enjoy the rest of your day, and try not to breathe too deeply out there, because I know they're spraying pretty heavily.
Yes, geoengineering is next on my list with the activism. I'm just starting to understand, and after getting acquainted with the documentary, especially why in the world are they spraying? That was one of the things that really brought to light the events that are unfolding now, and we're seeing it. I'm looking right up at it in Northern California. It's not supposed to look like this. It's pretty disturbing. But thank you for doing all this work and for keeping us abreast of all of these issues. And yeah, so hopefully we'll talk more about other things.
Great. Take care, Heather.
You too.
That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.